Welcome to Plant Power. This is episode 5, and I'm happy to welcome back nutrition scientists Weston Bussler and Brandon Metzger. A few weeks ago, we talked with Weston and Brandon about the whole food matrix, and we're going to continue that conversation today with a discussion on the utilization of nutrients, how nutrient bioavailability, bioaccessibility, and other factors affect how our body is equipped to utilize the nutrients we consume in food. As always, don't forget to stick around after the interview to hear clinical insights from practitioner Dave Hogshead.
Hi, this is Sarah, Kara, and Megan, and we're here today with Dr. Weston Bussler and Dr. Brandon Metzger. And we're going to expand our conversation that we had last time in regards to the whole food matrix. And today we're going to dive into some of these terms that can be really confusing to individual, the difference between bioavailability, bioaccessibility, absorptability, those type of things. So let's start with this term bioavailability. We hear it quite a bit in popular press and other places where, no, you might be consuming something, but it might not have the effects you want because it's not available. So, Weston, can you give me a little bit of insight to what does that term bioavailability mean?
Yeah, sure. So nutrient bioavailability, that's going to be the rate, proportion, and extent that an active substance or some kind of a therapeutic component from food is absorbed and becomes available after we digest it at a particular site. So like within the body, we have a bunch of different places that things can be active, be it the brain or the lower GI or the liver. But specific nutrient bioavailability, it's associated with that efficiency of how it's absorbed and the efficiency of the absorption itself and the metabolic utilization of that nutrient, or it can be any sort of phytochemical. And really, bioavailability is this important thing in all aspects of human biology. But from a nutrition perspective, we usually look at things like phytochemicals or essential nutrients primarily.
So, Brandon, is there an example that maybe you could give about bioavailability and where, like, if things aren't bioavailable and how maybe sometimes in a processing way you can improve upon that?
Yeah, sure. There's lots of examples of, you know, whether it's a particular, you know, fraction of maybe a fruit or a cereal seed or other things like the other components within the meal. So, for example, one of the things that's been shown about the bioavailability of things like lycopene, a phytochemical from tomato, is that processing can actually have a very profound effect on the absorption of the lycopene phytochemical in the body. So the presence of fat will help the absorption of that lycopene molecule, as well as the degree of processing. So a lot of times we think of processing as a negative attribute on the nutrients that are in our food source. But in some cases, depending upon the group of nutrients or phytochemicals that are there, processing can actually help break down the matrix, like what happens during digestion, whether it's the breakdown of fiber components or a proportion of the carbohydrate. You can actually increase the utilization of the body for things like lycopene. Classic example was a study out of the University of Illinois that showed that the actual canning process to produce tomato paste increased the bioavailability of the lycopene itself compared to fresh tomatoes.
So I think that's really interesting, right? That, you know, we don't always think about that the processing can improve the bioavailability. You know, another example, and maybe Weston, you can give me some more insight. You know, I think a lot of people hear about turmeric, right, as an example. And, you know, there's some information out there in popular press that you've got to eat so much. But if you can enhance the bioavailability, then you can improve it. Do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, maybe how turmeric, as an example, has a negative or a positive effect based on how it's treated?
Yeah, so turmeric and the bioactive, the specific bioactives in turmeric are curcumin, the curcuminoids. These things are very well known for being fat soluble and lipophilic compounds. But once they're ingested in Oh, and when you look at them in a lot of animal and cell culture models, they're just absolutely incredible. And the bioactivity that they display there, particularly with the anti-inflammatory action that it can induce. But when you look at these human clinical trials, there's a lot of difficulty in us absorbing that curcumin material for it to be able to reach the spots where we would be really interested in it making to. So a lot of efforts have actually been made within the industry in order to enhance that absorption, whether it's pairing curcumin with very specific other types of compounds that can help with that absorptive process. You have certain certain technologies that have been done to make a complex that is able to work in that more liquid environment that is our that is in our body. And that, all in all, there's been some pretty big gains in the bioavailability side that have been made when it comes to turmeric and curcumin.
Great. I think that's a really interesting way that we can think about things, because if we read this information, a lot of times we're considering like, hey, I want to take this herb or this plant, but then I don't get the effectiveness because it's not bioavailable. And, you know, we read a lot about that. So another term that we kind of threw around earlier is this bioaccessibility. So Weston, can you explain what that means compared to bioavailability? Because they sound really similar, and maybe from a layperson, it really gets to be confusing. So what are the differences, and what is really important to know about those differences?
Bioaccessibility is pretty easily understood as the ability for our bodies digestive and metabolism mechanisms to interact with a particular component. So in a food system, it's most easily looked at is the structure and architecture of that food preventing a lot of our digestive enzymes and our digestive mechanics from being able to reach that. So when you're looking at things like cereal grains, if you were to ingest a cereal grain that hasn't been damaged, so it's in that true form, you were to just pull it off the plants and then undo it a little bit and then just swallow it whole, that seed is going to contain all sorts of different nutrients within it that are important for that seed to grow, all the carbohydrates, all the vitamins and minerals. But since it's packaged in a particular way with that cell wall, it can kind of prevent any of that interaction with our digestive mechanisms. So what you see is a complete difference in the bioaccessibility of milled flour versus a whole seed. That milled flour, it's broken apart and put into a way that our body can directly interact with a lot of these components. Another thing would be if you take that cereal grain and you wind up boiling it and you disrupt a lot of the mechanisms of it, or the cellular structure of it, sorry. And when you disrupt that cellular structure, then all of a sudden it's much easier for us to masticate, to chew, in order to allow a lot of those digestive enzymes to reach the regions that they need to in order to break it down and digest it.
So how does the concept of absorption fit into both bioavailability and bioaccessibility? Like, is it separate, or is it part of both of those concepts?
Those concepts kind of come together, because mm-hmm. bioaccessibility does affect bioavailability. Bioavailability doesn't really have an impact on the bioaccessibility. That's more of like I would say that that's a little bit more independent in itself. It doesn't really, like, one happens before the other. If something's not bioaccessible, then the bioavailability becomes a little redundant. But I think some of the unique things that you can, some of the unique examples is how we as humans have kind of used this concept in ways that harnessed it in ways that would be beneficial for our health. So in the supplement and drug industry, even, a lot of capsules are used. And oftentimes these capsules are made to help a certain bioactive or any kind of material really reach a point where it would get into the body without damaging it and allowing it to be taken in the body in a way that would make it effective, right? So if that capsule wasn't there and you just took that powder or something dissolved in water, then it reaches our, it interacts right in our mouth with all the salivary enzymes. As it moves into the stomach, you start to see this pH effect, the very, very low acidic pH that can really disrupt a lot of compounds. But then if this capsule has been there to basically make it less bioaccessible through that region, but it's designed to dissolve once it reaches the lower GI, then all of a sudden you're transporting a nutrient or some other thing into a region where it's more bioavailable to us as long as you bypass those initial steps. So we really do utilize both of them to help us out with all sorts of different things in the health industry.
So Brandon, you know, this concept that Weston was talking about, you know, the capsules and different things, you know, we've had conversations about probiotics and the pH and, you know, how those are capsulized. You know, does that also have the same effect in things like a probiotic?
Yeah, for certain. I mean, there are, you know, probiotics as a class of supplements is, I guess, compared to a lot of classes of phytonutrients in the fact that we don't call them, you know, photosensitive, but they have their own set of properties that definitely are known to kind of degrade the viability of those organisms. And so things, you know, typically like moisture content of the probiotics in their environment, whatever that is, whether it's inside of a capsule or inside of a container that those capsules are put into, even the location, you know, throughout the U.S. and world where those capsules are stored, can have an effect on the what we call viability or the ability to thrive of those probiotics in the body. And so that gets to a point that I wanted to make, kind of piggybacking on what Weston was saying. You know, we talk about all these sort of influences that affect both bioavailability, bioaccessibility, and ultimately absorption. A lot of those things, you know, are unknown because, you know, you take a supplement or a nutrient from a food together with all sorts of other components in the diet. As Weston's describing it, it depends upon, you know, the solid dose, what we call the solid dose format of that supplement. So whether it's a capsule or a soft gel or a tablet. It could be coated or non-coated. There are a lot of factors there. And that really points to the importance of science and understanding absorption of nutrients and why we, you know, one example of why you need to do robust, you know, clinical trials to understand the absorption of these nutrients and their effects on health. I mean, that has really become, you know, a well-designed way to understand all of the potential influences when taken under a suggested kind of serving design with the intended package, whether that's capsule or tablet or soft gel.
So based on Weston's description of bioavailability and bioaccessibility and what Brandon was saying about the viability of probiotics delivered in nutritional supplements, it sounds like there are just so many factors affecting these two measures of how a nutrient can be utilized, that there may not be an exact science for determining with 100% accuracy how available or accessible a nutrient might be in a given scenario. So next, Sarah, you ask Brandon and Weston about what could be going on within the human body that may be impacting nutrient bioavailability and bioaccessibility, and how maybe that looks different from person to person.
One other thing, maybe either Brandon or Weston you can address, is so our bodies. So if somebody has a GI issue or some other issue, does that affect the individual's ability to have bioavailability of a specific nutrient? And can you address maybe how our individual health and our own systems have an effect?
I think one of the good examples there that you would look at is a substance our body produces called bile. When we ingest fatty substances, these fatty substances, a lot like the how when you talk about like the turmeric and how that our body's a primary liquid environment, having something like bile, it creates this ability for our body to uptake a lot of these fatty compounds into the into that more liquid-based environment. And it acts as almost an emulsifier for those fats to help them suspend in there. And a lot of people actually will have some difficulty with either producing too much or too little bile. And ultimately, this can start to have some impacts on how they ingest things. Particularly, you would look at like various fatty substances and fatty vitamins or fat-soluble vitamins, and that could start to become some kind of an issue you would look at there.
One example I was thinking of is actually, you know, lower down in the digestive tract, you know, with a case like dysbiosis, where you have, you know, an imbalance of different micropopulations. Those specific microbial populations are suited very well to digest different types of foods and macronutrients. You know, some lactic acid bacteria are very efficient in breaking down, you know, carbohydrates and releasing certain nutrients. Others have certain enzymes that they're able to produce to break down fats through lipases. So depending upon the, you know, dysbiosis or the state of the lower GI, you can definitely have an influence on which nutrients can be utilized.
Mm-hmm. If we're also thinking higher up and we're thinking about protein, right, and if it's not able to break down, if, you know, we don't have the right pH or we're not producing enough pepsin and other pancreatic enzymes, that, you know, can have an effect of absorbing those amino acids further down too. So it's all very complicated, right? And our bodies are complicated and the nutrients that we bring in are a bit complicated. But how would it, you know, if you were going to take kind of this one really juicy nugget away to help people understand, what would you say it is to understand this concept of bioavailability in the simplest terms? Weston and then Brandon.
Well, I would say that bioavailability is something that it's always going to be looked at as a double-edged sword. So sometimes you try to have things that are where increasing the bioavailability of them is the answer, and that's what you want. But if you're looking in other cases where individuals may benefit from, say, not having something be as bioavailable, I would look at certain people with a lot of issues with glucose metabolism. Making that glucose more bioavailable isn't always going to be the best thing for a person. So when you look at something like a complex food matrix, oftentimes some of the benefit you see from it is that there are certain things in there that slow that rate of absorption and can affect the overall bioavailability, either prolonging it over a longer period of time or just reducing some of it in general. Some of our body may even be using that as some kind of a defense mechanism from getting too much of any one thing at a time. So it's really important to remember that it can be something that you look to increase, but bioavailability can be also something where decreasing it can be beneficial as well. It's just going to always depend on the particular nutrient, the other phytochemical of interest, and the individual themselves and what their individual needs are. So it's really important to look at each one as its own case separately.
I would say, you know, to follow up on what Weston was saying there, that individual variability can be very large when it comes to what we know about absorption. And of course, there's all sorts of things that we don't know. So, you know, we know that within the human population, absorption of nutrients, given the same food source or even the same, you know, apple across a number of people, has very different profiles of absorption of those key nutrients. And some of those things, you know, we can control by designing the right sort of supplement design to maximize the concentration, maximize the form that the nutrient is packaged in, or the process to produce that. But there are all sorts of other unknown variables that we can't control. You know, the amount of enzyme present, as Weston was describing, in the mouth that initially begins acting upon the food or supplement is something that, you know, you probably don't understand, but it's also very highly variable. And you follow down through the digestive process, and there's all these other, you know, individual variability that has an effect. So the best that we can do is what we know, and that is delivering the best quality, best process, highest concentration, in some cases, in other cases, you know, other other beneficial macronutrients to help the absorption, or technology even that can be used to really maximize the delivery of that nutrient to the body. But you can't control, obviously, everything in human physiology.
So we've talked a lot about these factors that affect how nutrients are absorbed after we, you know, consume things. So I thought maybe it might be helpful for the listener to talk about why absorbing nutrients is so important and kind of talking about the details of that.
I mean, if nutrients aren't being absorbed, then you have a little bit, then you're not going to be reaching a lot of those requirements that make them essential. So our body needs all of these different essential compounds and building blocks to do everything. Every biological function requires a lot of these nutrients. And that's that, whether or not it's simply just protein, things of that nature, the macronutrients that are very, very important for daily activities, or you also have the phytos that themselves may not be essential, but they can be utilized for some particular benefits. So for the essential ones, we know those are necessary for us to live, and that's why they've been deemed that way. And those would be a lot of those classical nutrition vitamins, minerals, and things that are necessary. But these phytos, they're not always necessary, but they can be helpful. So it's just going to kind of depend on their mode of action. And we're actually still learning quite a bit on a lot of these phytochemicals and how they may be interacting with our bodies.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, whenever we start talking about foods and nutrition and nutrients and, you know, complex topics like bioavailability, you can really simplify that as, you know, getting the benefits of the makeup for our cells, whether that's, you know, brain tissue that's rich in lipids, or liver tissue that needs functional cellular enzymes, or you know, cells at the extremities of our body. They all have like a certain unique need for different proteins or lipids for the makeup of what they do. And it's really interesting, you know, whenever we talk about nutrition, it really, the core of that is the GI system. So the absorption of these foods and all the barriers that foods and nutrients have to get through as they eventually work their way into cellular systems and processes and metabolism really starts at the core of digestion. So, you know, I know in the practitioner world, the digestive tract and the health of the digestive system is really core to the utilization of foods and nutrients. And as we've kind of discussed throughout this series, you can begin to see why.
I just thought so many people who maybe don't think too deeply about their nutrition might not think twice about, I ate it, why wouldn't I absorb it? You know, like I ate the apple, why wouldn't I absorb all the nutrients? So I think it's something that people take for granted if they don't give, you know, nutrition science a second thought, which, you know, a lot of people don't. Right. 'Cause I think that people like us, a natural thought process to think this way, but for some people, they might not even consider that bioavailability and bioaccessibility, like, that is even a something to think about, like, you know, the whole concept of you don't know what you don't know.
I think it's really important to like consider for that question what nutrient you're talking about and everything, because so our body has that initial first pass metabolism that's really important. And that's going to be where a lot of the sugars are taken up, a lot of the proteins, and those proteins get broken down into amino acids, and those get taken up, as well as a lot of minerals and small nutrients that wind up being absorbed through very specific uptake mechanisms in the small intestine through the enterocytes, or by some kind of a passive diffusion, just where there's a gradient and they move in on their own. But then you have a lot of this like secondary uptake that winds up occurring via the interaction with the microbes in the gut. So a lot of those things that our body can't consume, primary example is fiber. And the fiber our body literally can't digest. That's part of the reason that it is fiber. And it reaches that lower GI. It plays a huge role for helping to move things through the system. I mean, it's just a big tube and you have all these smooth muscle tissues that are moving things through, but having a larger food bolus with things that our body doesn't digest and it doesn't just dissolve in one particular way helps push things through. And then those reach the lower GI where they interact with all these different trillions and trillions and trillions of microbes. And those microbes, they'll see all these plant phytonutrients. They'll see these plant carbohydrates that are unavailable to us, but these microbes have the enzymes and the machinery to digest that, so they can break them down, use them for energy, and they create new compounds. And these new compounds, sometimes they're something that can be directly absorbed by us. Other times they're going to produce things that, say, lower the pH in the lower GI tract. So you produce various acids, short chain fatty acids like butyrate, propionate, and acetate, as well as things like just lactic acid. Like a lot of these lactic acid producing bacteria, they do that. So you get the slightly acidic pH in the colon, and that's really important for controlling the growth of certain microbes. If you get too high of a pH, you're actually vulnerable to certain microbes being able to take a overwhelming hold in the GI and start to cause a lot of problems. You see this in certain people with where like C. diff becomes a problem, but then all sorts of these different other phytonutrients, they get modified into ways that our body might be able to uptake them. So you have polyphenolics that are really large, really large compounds. Those get broken down by certain microbes into smaller ones. Then you get to something like a quercetin, and then that gets broken down even further. So you can release it from the glycoside residue, and then all of a sudden you have a free aglycone quercetin that's able to interact and then ultimately move through our into our systemic circulation and wind up eliciting some internal effects. So it just, it's kind of really depend on everything.
I was thinking too, Weston, while you're just talking, when you mentioned the microbiome, because whenever we talk about gut microbes, you talk about how humans have evolved with, you know, gut microbes being basically a part of the way we function. And then in previous episodes, we've talked about how humans and plants have evolved together and they're in a relationship. And so I wonder too how, and this may be speculative, but how bioavailability and bioaccessibility have changed over, you know, hundreds, thousands of years, where humans are changing because of plants and humans are changing because of gut bacteria, and how those, the things that we're consuming from plants and things inside of us are co-living with us as microbes, how that those two things affect the way we absorb nutrients. And there's not a simple answer to it, but I'm just... Isn't that interesting, though, to think that there's these two factors, like externally and internally, that are like evolving with us, that, but then eventually like indirectly affect each other?
There's where you have that bitter hypothesis, right? That these bitter tasting plants and things, that our body recognizes them as bitter in order to say, oh, wait a second, this might be poisonous. This might kill me. Let's slow down that absorption and that uptake of stuff really quick. And then that winds up reducing our ability to, that may affect the blood glucose response by reducing blood glucose levels. And I mean, these things are just in the theoretical stage, but there's a lot of hypotheses and theories behind behind why those, like how our body responds to things like plant bitters. So you look through our whole GI tract, and we actually have bitter receptors on the entire GI tract. And it's hard to imagine that they're not there for some particular reason.
Mm. Our taste in food has become so much more sweet, to your kind of point that those bitters have been taken out, but those bitters had a real important factor, right? Either because, like you said, they were poisonous, or maybe, you know, we don't really know, right? Or were they to reduce the energy needs, or, you know, we're still like figuring that all out. It's really fascinating.
Yeah. And I mean, from the plant's perspective, one of the questions to always think about is it beneficial for a plant to be eaten or not? So
I think from the plant's perspective, no, I don't want to be eaten.
Well, but for the entire species, like does the plant wind up moving by being something that we want, we wind up cultivating it. Is that what's beneficial for the plants? It's hard to tell.
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating. I think the other thing, you know, the discussion about the microbiome is something that we're still learning so much about the microbiome that we didn't know 20 years ago, and how it has an effect on overall absorption and nutrient availability, right? It's really fascinating. And really every day we're learning more.
Yeah, I mean, that's the microbiome, you know, as a field of study really has emerged in my short career to be looked at as, you know, a source of nutrient absorption because of the kind of frustration in being able to clearly identify the absorption of things like polyphenols. You know, there was observational data that things like cranberries and pomegranates and tea and chocolate had demonstrated health benefits, whether it's, you know, control of glucose levels or cholesterol levels, other metabolic parameters. And they couldn't show that these things were clearly absorbed in the upper GI. So like that was kind of the first initial thought. And through that frustration, you know, more and more researchers began to look at, you know, lower down in the GI tract. And lo and behold, a lot of these complex polyphenols are bound to proteins, are bound to fibers. And it takes a long time, like through the digestive process, to release those things. And then beyond that, a lot of them were shown to need to be biotransformed. So some of these populations within the gut can actually change the structure of these polyphenols so that they can then be broken down further to release new molecules that had to be discovered. So the research in, you know, the absorption of nutrients from foods continues to kind of move down into this like unknown territory of the phytochemistry and, you know, enzymes and how they interact and how new glucose units are attached. You know, the body is very complex to utilize and make use of what's in food. And something as what we thought as easy as the health benefits of chocolate became a very complicated story.
Well, thank you, Weston and Brandon, for this robust conversation about bioavailability, bioaccessibility, and absorption, and all things in between, how our gut is interacting with the foods that we consume. Now we're going to have a conversation with Dave Hogshead to understand the clinical aspects and how he addresses these discussions in his clinic.
Hi everyone, Dave Hogshead here, and I hope you enjoyed that presentation about bioavailability, bioaccessibility, and absorption, and how much all three of those issues can greatly influence the effectiveness of a food or a whole food supplement. And one of the most clinically relevant absorption and bioavailability issues was brought up by my good friend Sarah, and that is the curcuminoids in turmeric. Curcuminoids are one of the most clinically researched phytochemicals in natural medicine, over 14,000 studies. And we rely on the power of curcuminoids for so many types of cases that we see in practice every day. Turmeric is one of our most important herbs for supporting a healthy inflammation response, and especially musculoskeletal inflammation. The curcuminoids in turmeric also support brain health, metabolism, cardiovascular protection, phase 2 liver detoxification, and upregulation of NRF2, one of the most protective antioxidants in the body. And we could go on and on about the benefits of curcuminoids in turmeric. There's a lot of good news about turmeric. But the bad news is there are some really big absorption and bioavailability issues with the curcuminoids in turmeric that dramatically influence its clinical results. And the first one is what most people are already familiar with, and that's the absorption issue. The curcuminoids in turmeric are poorly absorbed in the gastrointestinal tract. So the most popular and well-known way to increase curcuminoid absorption is by taking it with black pepper. And there are other good ways to increase absorption of curcuminoids, like phospholipid curcuminoids. And these kinds of things really do work well to increase the absorption of curcuminoids in the digestive tract, in some cases, up to 30 times better absorption. So it's great that more and more people are aware that you need to take something with turmeric for better absorption of the curcuminoids. But what most people don't know anything about is the second big bioavailability issue. And that's the liver's conjugation of curcuminoids. When those curcuminoids from turmeric are absorbed through the digestive tract, they have to pass through the liver. And when they're metabolized through the liver, the conjugated end product can be less biologically active than the free curcuminoids found in turmeric. And that's a really important term to remember, free curcuminoids. So the goal is not just to absorb curcuminoids better. We definitely need to pay attention to that, but we also need to protect and preserve the more potent free curcuminoids as they go through the liver. Black pepper doesn't do that effectively. Eating turmeric with fat doesn't do that effectively. The most effective way that we know of right now to both increase the absorption of curcuminoids and to protect the free potent curcuminoids as they pass through the liver is to infuse turmeric into fenugreek fiber. Fenugreek fiber contains a compound called galactomannosides. And these galactomannosides have been shown to increase the absorption of curcuminoids by about 25 times in the digestive tract. But that's really not the magic of the fenugreek fiber, because there are plenty of other ways to increase the absorption of curcuminoids, like black pepper. What makes the galactomannosides in fenugreek fiber so powerful is their ability to preserve those potent inflammation-modulating free curcuminoids as they go through the liver. Again, the free curcuminoids are what provide the most beneficial effects for supporting a healthy inflammation response, and free curcuminoids are much better absorbed across the blood-brain barrier for both the brain protection effects of curcuminoids and helping get inflammation under control in the brain tissue itself. So turmeric is one of the most important herbs to be aware of for making sure that you're addressing the multiple absorption and bioavailability issues with. But some herbs and nutrients have very simple solutions for their bioavailability or absorption challenges. An herb that works beautifully with turmeric for inflammation support is Boswellia. And those boswellic acids that make Boswellia so good for modulating inflammation are much better absorbed with fat. Some estimates are up to 5 times better absorption of boswellic acids when you consume them with fat in a meal. So you could be taking the best Boswellia supplement on the planet, but if you're not taking it with fat, you're not going to experience the full benefits. And that can be fat in a meal or fat as a supplement, especially a fish oil supplement. A fish oil supplement is a great, simple way to ensure the boswellic acids are absorbed, but it also, of course, has the benefits of being great for modulating inflammation in its own right. And in addition to all of the nutrient and herbal bioavailability issues that are out there you need to be aware of, I also loved how they discussed the digestion issues that can greatly influence how well your food or your food supplements are absorbed and utilized. This is something we literally see every single day in practice. And starting with the stomach, that hydrochloric acid produced in the stomach is a make or break issue for so many nutrients. You need that stomach acid and pepsin to break down protein. But you also need hydrochloric acid for the right pH in the stomach to ensure mineral absorption, minerals like calcium, magnesium, and iron. So you can take great mineral supplements, but if you aren't making enough stomach acid, you won't get the full benefit. You also need hydrochloric acid for the intrinsic factor in your stomach to absorb B12 properly. And we could go on and on about all of the nutrients that require hydrochloric acid for optimal absorption. And what makes insufficient hydrochloric acid such a big bioavailability and absorption factor with supplements is there are so many factors that can interfere with our body's ability to make stomach acid. It's a really common problem. First of all, B vitamin and zinc deficiencies can interfere with stomach acid production, and deficiencies are pretty common with both B vitamins and zinc in this country. A lot of that has to do with our modern diet. Secondly, the older you get, the more likely you are not to make enough stomach acid and digestive enzymes. And that absorption problem becomes compounded once someone starts taking a prescription or over-the-counter antacid medication. Those medications are great for relieving the symptoms of poor digestion, burning, acid reflux, things like that, but they make nutrient absorption so much more difficult. And another reason behind why so many of us don't make sufficient hydrochloric acid for nutrient absorption is found in our modern American diet. The average American is not eating the most important foods for encouraging a healthy pH in the stomach. And those are bitter foods and herbs. Bitter herbs like gentian can greatly benefit the entire digestive tract and ensure proper nutrient absorption. And you can either incorporate bitter herbs into the diet or take them as supplements. But you're going to find that these low stomach acid issues, especially in your older adult patients, are so common that most of them are going to greatly benefit from taking either a betaine hydrochloride supplement to encourage hydrochloric acid production in the right pH, or to take bitter herbs as a supplement. Those simple digestion aids can make a major difference in the absorption of nutrients in food and food supplements. But if the common problem of low stomach acid didn't present enough nutrient absorption challenges, Weston mentioned another very important digestion component for nutrient absorption, and one that a lot of people have problems with, and that is the bile flow from the gallbladder. Bile is essential to break down fat into smaller particles for better absorption. It emulsifies fat. But again, our modern American diet just doesn't support optimal bile production and flow. And just one example is most people in this country don't eat nearly enough of one of the most, if not the most effective foods for supporting healthy bile production. And those are beets, both the beetroot and the beet leaf. And when we don't eat foods like this to support our bile, it can become too thick. We can get gallstones, and the bile isn't released into the digestive tract properly. And then we don't absorb beneficial fats the way we should. And we all know how important essential fatty acid supplements are, like fish oil supplements. But if you have a gallbladder problem, you can take a really high quality fish oil, but you won't be guaranteed to fully absorb the essential fatty acids from that supplement. And the same goes with fat soluble vitamins like vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin E, and K. And someone may even feel uncomfortable with burping or nauseous after they take that fish oil supplement because the bile isn't there to break it down for absorption. So these very common gallbladder problems can present a big challenge for absorbing fats and fat-soluble nutrients properly. But the good news is there are a lot of great concentrated food and herbal supplements to help get that gallbladder and bile flow back on track, and especially the supplements that contain beetroot and beet leaf. And then you have a lot of patients that don't even have their gallbladder anymore. They've had it surgically removed. And that brings up a really important point for absorption. Whenever someone has had their gallbladder removed, it's very important for them to take a bile salt supplement when they eat fat to compensate for that missing gallbladder. So again, any food or food supplement that contains fat really depends on bile for maximum effectiveness. And then Brandon mentioned the third and very common digestion challenge to proper absorption, and that is dysbiosis. We have so many challenges today for maintaining a healthy gut microbiome. We've got excessive sugar consumption, antibiotics, excessive alcohol, chlorine in the water, and all of these interfere with our beneficial bacteria from thriving. And those probiotics in our gut, so many of them are important in the ability of our digestive tract to absorb nutrients. So always keep in mind the need for probiotic and prebiotic support for optimal absorption and bioavailability of nutrients in food or food supplements. So if you know how to address optimal stomach acid for digestion or protein and absorption of minerals with using supplements like betaine hydrochloride and bitter herbs, if you know how to support healthy bile flow from the gallbladder for optimal fat absorption, especially with beetroot and beet leaf supplements, and if you know how to support a healthy gut microbiome with probiotics and prebiotics, you'll do wonders for ensuring your patients get the most benefit out of their diet and their whole food supplement program. So absorption and bioavailability issues are a big deal for successful clinical outcomes. And I want to thank everyone for putting together this great podcast to remind us of how important it is to address these issues. See you next time.
Thank you to all of our guests for a fantastic episode. There's just one episode left in Plant Power, and it's all about taking what we've learned over the past few weeks and understanding how to apply these nutrition concepts in practice and in everyday life. Visit holisticmatters.com for more. That's holistic with a W.